From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Naps Chat. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. Both houses of Congress have left Washington after a divisive July, which started with the controversial 2025 Budget Reconciliation Act and recessed with the uproar over the content of the Jeffrey Epstein files. In the postal world, prior to the summer recess, the House Subcommittee on Government Operations conducted a hearing on the prevention of postal-related crime and mail theft. NAPS Executive Vice President Chuck Mulledor offered testimony in support of H.R. 2095, the Postal Police Reform Act, legislation that would restore postal police authority to protect postal employees, postal property, and the mail, both on and off postal property. In the year 2020, the Postal Service revoked that authority. In addition, Vice President Mulledor, in his testimony, highlighted the recent findings of a Postal Inspector General audit, which identified mail theft at a privatized Denver mail transportation hub, and cautioned that efforts to privatize mail processing and logistics would lead to further increases in mail theft. Also last week, the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs withheld consideration of the two individuals President Trump nominated to the Postal Board of Governors back in June, Anthony Lamangino and John Laval. So the nominations will probably be taken up during the fall. There are presently four vacancies on the Board of Governors. Now let's turn to our NAPS Chat guest. This week, I am indeed honored to be joined by former Washington Post columnist Joe Davidson. Joe has a distinguished career with the Detroit News, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Wall Street Journal, and most recently, the Washington Post. For the past 17 years, Joe has written the column entitled Washington Insider for the Post, which was regularly published, and it appeared multiple times a week in the Washington Post. It covered the federal workforce, as well as the postal workforce, as well as the federal government. Joe is a member of the National Association of Black Journalists Hall of Fame and is a trusted and respected reporter, particularly among those in the public service. Regrettably, Joe resigned from the Post a few weeks ago. His departure will leave a cavernous void in the coverage of issues that are of concern to millions of Americans. Welcome to Naps Chat, Joe.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here. Just a minor correction. It was called the Federal Diary. I mean, the Federal Insider. Before that, the Federal Diary, but in the Washington Post.
Let me start by asking about the importance and value of a column in a national newspaper dedicated to covering issues of consequence to those who serve the public. Why is such a column important to civil servants and to a well-informed public?
Well, as you said, public servants serve the public. And so, therefore, what happens to public servants, in this case, federal employees, is crucial to the way the government serves its taxpayers. And so when there are issues that can affect the employment of those, some 2 million people, not even including, hundreds of thousands in the Postal Service, it has a direct impact on how the government treats its citizens.
Do you think there is a relationship between how the government treats its employees and how the government treats its citizens?
Well, I think so. I think that, for example, if you look at some of the current issues involving cuts by President Trump, those cuts really can affect the way the service to the American people. If, for example, people in environmental agencies, if they're being cut, then that means environmental services are likely being cut. If the employees at the Social Security Administration or the IRS are being cut, then people might have to wait much longer to get service when they call those agencies. So the way the government treats its employees, yes, has a direct impact on the service to the public.
As you know, Colonial and Early American Postal Service's primary mission, besides carrying correspondence, mm-hmm. was to convey newspapers. In many areas of the country, particularly rural ones, the American public is still reliant on the modern postal service. I am curious if you believe the wide dissemination of print news throughout the country is still important. I might add, as distinct from cable news and online chat boxes.
Well, I can tell you it's important to me because I get three newspapers every day. Of course, I've long defined myself as a newspaper person, even in the digital age. And everything, of course, is now digital first at the Washington Post and other news organizations. But I believe that the print product definitely has a place, you know, in the American conversation. But it's also true that the print product has been diminished over the years, certainly in terms of circulation. There are far fewer print subscribers now than before. So in some ways, you know, the American public is voting in favor of digital over print. And that's the way, I guess, modern technology moves. Some things are, they're fine for the moment, and then technology grows and things that become outdated. I'm glad to see print products remain, however. I do think that there's a certain place in American society for them, and I hope there will always be a place. I mean, I think there's certain levels of convenience to the print product that I don't find online. And I read, you know, online on my phone and the paper product, but I still like that paper product very much.
Do you think the migration to more news articles and news content, moving it to digital format, has impacted the quality of journalism in the United States?
Not necessarily, and certainly not so much now. Early on, I think that there was this massive, in the digital age of newspapers, I think there was this rush to be first all of the time. And what that did was, sometimes the writers, years ago, were allowed to publish before it went through a thorough editing process. And I think that brought about some errors in certain cases. Some things had to be changed. I think, you know, all writers need editors. And I think it was a mistake years ago to allow writers to basically publish their own work before it went through a thorough vetting or editing process. Now, in this digital first age, where the print product is not, you know, it's simply not purchased as much as it used to be. And there are structures in place so that everything that goes online does go through the kind of vetting that that is needed.
Let's talk about specific issues that you covered during your career. When you first inherited the column, at that time, as you said, the Federal Diary column,
right.
It was during the latter part of the presidency of George W. Bush.
That's right.
What were some of those memorable issues that you covered at the very early stage of the Federal Diary column?
Well, I think that I guess I'll answer the question this way, rather than talk about a specific issue, because a lot of these issues have long been around, a lot of pay and benefit issues. I'll tell you what impressed me early on, and that was the dedication of federal employees to their mission. And so I covered that. I mean, that was something I covered early in the sense that I would talk with federal employees and their conversations about what they were doing on a particular project really informed my understanding of how much sincerity and integrity federal employees bring to their jobs, because so many employees would talk to me about the mission of their agencies. And I simply was very impressed on that. And so I covered that in the sense that every time I'm writing a story, I'm understanding more and more about how much their jobs mean to them as individuals, not simply as a paycheck, but as a way of bringing service to the American people.
Now, there are so many stories out there that you could write about this dedicated public workforce. How did you choose which stories were worthy of your attention and therefore appeared in print?
Well, often it simply had to do with stories that I found interesting, and I wanted to make them interesting to the public as well. And sometimes that can be difficult. I mean, it's like everybody doesn't necessarily care about the federal employees' health benefit program or those insurance programs in the postal sector. But those were also topics that needed to be covered. And so some of my stories really weren't necessarily for the larger audience. They were for federal employees, but you know, they're like 2 million federal employees. So that's a very important audience, and certainly in the DC area. But often it was, as a columnist, I had the ability to choose what I wanted to write about. And so I found different ways, at least I sought to find different ways to make these stories important to the larger public. And in some cases, it had to do with, you know, again, how a change in the federal workforce might affect the public. So I tried to always make a point, to the extent that I could, linking the jobs that the federal employees do, the way they are treated, their pay, their benefits, all of that, disciplinary measures, try to link that to how does this serve the public.
The way in which you approached these topics changed from administration to administration.
Mm-hmm.
George W. Bush, the first term versus the second term of President Obama, as we moved to do President Trump phase one, President Biden, President Trump phase two. How has that changed your perspective of federal employees, how you covered federal employee issues, and your reaction to what this whole ecosystem in which federal employees operate,
Of course, the big change was the aggressive attacks by Donald Trump on federal employees. You know, the Republicans, I learned early on that Republicans generally sought to limit pay and benefits of federal employees, sought to impose greater disciplinary avenues, wanted to limit the size of the federal workforce. These topics have long been part of the Republican agenda. However, when Trump came in particular during this term, you know, he made those moves in a much, much, much more aggressive manner, to the point of trying to strip some federal workers of their civil service protections. And again, I think this is an issue that's important to the public at large, if they understand it. And so the presidents largely drive the agenda. And so as a reporter covering the federal workforce, a lot of my stories were geared to what was coming out of either the White House or Congress, and that certainly did change with administrations. I mean, Biden prided himself on being such a close friend of federal employees. Trump, on the other hand, makes no bones about it that he thinks they're swamp dwellers.
Yeah, I want to touch upon that. I want to carry on, you know, over the past 8 months at least. Mm-hmm. So many patriotic Americans who've dedicated their lives to public service appear to have been ridiculed, traumatized, and in times demonized for what they do. Am I giving an accurate depiction of what's going on? And if I am accurate in that depiction, how do you think public servants should respond?
Well, I think that's true, the way you described it, and it's worse than that because they've been fired. I mean, I think they've been treated really harshly, cruelly. I mean, I think federal employees have been treated cruelly because of the way they've been treated, shut out of their offices, you know, told to leave, sometimes put on leave and called back. I mean, I think that the Trump administration has treated federal employees is really cruel in many cases. I think that the way they respond is they go to court, or their unions go to court for them. And in this political environment, though, it seems like they lose more often than they win. And Trump wins more often than he loses, because it's a right wing federal court that's you know, that's dominated by conservatives who tend to agree with Trump more than they tend to agree with, say, federal unions, for example. And so, federal employees have marched. They've demonstrated. They've contacted their elected representatives on the Hill. They've done all of these things, and in some cases, they've been able to push back a bit. But by and large, when you have a Supreme Court that is favorable to Donald Trump, then many of his moves are affirmed by that court.
I would just observe, when I first came to Washington, was back in the mid-early 1980s, mm-hmm. and Mike Causey was mm-hmm. covering the beat that you right. recently covered, the Federal Diary column. And at that point, it was the Reagan administration, and there was an OPM director named Donald Devine, mm-hmm. and they focused on pay and benefits, that mm-hmm. federal employees, postal employees are overpaid, mm-hmm. and their benefits are too generous.
Right.
If that was the only critique that mm-hmm. we would get right now, we could deal with it. But we're dealing with the essential nature of, is a federal workforce necessary, mm-hmm. and who is it beholden to? So it's sort of changed over the last 40 years over the
well,
criticism. It's,
oh, yeah. It definitely has changed, and Trump is accelerating that change greatly. I mean, he feels that he wants a federal workforce that is aligned to his personal agenda, much more so than any other president. That's why he has tried to institute policies that would make it much easier to fire federal employees, to really undermine their civil service protections. And this kind of gets back to another question of how things that affect feds might affect the public. You know, I'm a strong believer in the civil service system. And the civil service system has certain procedures before you can fire somebody. I do think it's true that sometimes those procedures can take a long time, but I think the essential nature of giving people who are being disciplined or fired a way to fight that, as opposed to being fired simply as an at-will employee, I think that's important. And it's important because you don't want a system where a spoil system, where essentially everybody is a political appointee. The essential nature, the fundamental part of the civil service system is that you have a nonpartisan civil service that treats people fairly no matter what their political party. But if everybody is a patronage employee, then those people who are aligned with that party are going to get favoritism, going to get better services, more services than those who are not. And I don't think that's the way this country should run. That's not the way the government is designed. But there is an effort to really undermine civil service protections for the federal workforce.
The irony is the modern civil service system was created by President Theodore Roosevelt, a progressive Republican,
right,
at the early part of the previous century.
That's right.
And it's sort of now flipped on its head,
mm-hmm.
the whole concept of the civil service about being nonpartisan, being responsive to the public rather than to political parties. I would just open at this point that we read recently that this administration wanted to fold the Postal Service mm-hmm. into an executive agency, the Department of Commerce, and thereby arguably subject them, mm-hmm. the Postal Service, to the same type of pressure that is currently being exerted on the rest of the federal government.
And for those who kind of favor that, you have to ask yourself, okay, you might be, if you're a Donald Trump supporter, you might be okay with that while he's in office. But nobody, he's not going to be in office forever. And the way this system works, the Republicans are not going to be in office forever. It goes back and forth. That's what history shows us. And so if you have a Republican president who finds a way to skew the civil service in favor of the Republican Party, then you get a Democrat in the next time. If he or she does the same thing, this becomes like a ping pong ball, and you don't have a stable civil service that's simply dedicated to serving the public as opposed to a political party. Now, civil servants realize that when you get a Republican in or a Democrat in, they're going to have different priorities. And civil servants are accustomed to that. They can fulfill their mission working within the political priorities of the person in office. But that's one thing. Stripping them of their civil service protections so that they can be fired and replaced by political partisans, that's a totally another story. And that's what many people are fighting right now.
Now, almost 12 years ago, Amazon owner Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. At that time, or probably during the first part of the Trump administration, Bezos and Trump were at loggerheads, in a large part because of the Postal Service. Trump believed that Bezos through Amazon was getting sweetheart deals from the Postal Service. Boy, did chimes change. Because mm-hmm. over in the ensuing years, it appears that Jeff Bezos is gradually taking a more active role in directing the editorial operations of the Washington Post, at the least being more sympathetic in its opinion page to this president. I understand that your departure from the Post reflected disappointment with your ability to express your opinions as you're doing so right now. In your column, Can I ask you what the nature of the opinions that you wanted to share were? You were not being able to share on your column?
There's a relatively new policy that the editor, who is the chief editor at the Post, implemented, I guess, late last year. He's been at the Post now a little bit more than a year, I think. And that policy, it was unwritten, number one, unannounced, that there would be no opinion or commentary on the news side of the page, of the papers, of the product, as opposed to the opinion side. Well, columns, by definition, have opinion and commentary. And at one point in April, one of my columns was held. In other words, it was killed. It wasn't published. And I was told it was because of this policy, which I had never heard of, about no opinion or commentary in the news side in terms of columns. I didn't know until that point that a couple of other news side columnists had moved from the news side to the opinion a few months earlier because of this policy. Again, this policy isn't written and it wasn't announced. And so, it was just hit me out of the blue. I knew then, frankly, that my days were probably numbered. But I wrote a couple of more columns, and the following column after that one was killed, it was about Congressman Jerry Connolly, who died not too long ago. Mm-hmm. And he was a great friend of federal employees and postal employees, and he represented a Northern Virginia district. And every year, or at least every Congress, every other year, he would introduce legislation calling for a really significant pay raise for federal employees. And I described that pay raise, or potential pay raise, as well-deserved. And they cut well-deserved out as a modifier for pay raise. Meanwhile, though, because this is an unwritten policy without any particular guidelines, at least a couple of other writers at the Post were also writing either columns or analyses, and they wrote things that were much more opinionated, in my view, about Donald Trump's policies, calling, for example, cruel, for example. And I just felt like I was a columnist without a column, because you can't have opinions in columns, and the policy is being enforced unevenly, that it was just time for me to go. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did.
Now, Washington is a company town, for all intents and purposes, with thousands and thousands of federal and postal employees residing and working in town. Mm-hmm. Has the editorial and opinion policy, this change of the Post, evolved into a policy that is not as responsive to its audience here in Washington?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, on the editorial side, and just kind of briefly for your listeners, news organizations, at least print news organizations, I'll call them newspapers just for this conversation. Now there's so much more than newspapers, but the newspapers have this wall between the editorial side, that's the opinion side, and the news side. And Jeff Bezos has instituted policies aimed at the editorial side. The policies that I confronted came from the editor of the news side, who of course was hired by Jeff Bezos. On the editorial side, Jeff Bezos now has guidelines about what can be covered and what can't be covered. Things like personal freedom can be covered, but still those guidelines are kind of nebulous. You don't know exactly what they mean. I think certainly that has the potential of, along with these issues in the news side, has the potential for reducing really the scrutiny of the Trump administration. Let me add, too, that I think the Post reporters on the news side continue to do a good job. I continue to respect the reporting that they do. But if you take away columns and analyses that have opinion or commentary, then, and right now, those who are writing those kinds of columns, such as I was, are generally critical of Trump. If you remove that, then you are removing some critical scrutiny of Trump. And so I don't see any way around that. While I think the policy can be justified, no opinion and commentary, it nonetheless goes against a longstanding tradition at the Post. And it certainly was different from the way I'd been writing my column for 17 years because, like I said, I've written things that were stronger in terms of language than the column that was held, and certainly much stronger than describing a pay raise as well-deserved. But even if that policy can be justified journalistically, that doesn't mean it's the only way to do it. There are news organizations that don't have any commentary and opinion in their news sections. And so, yeah, they're still putting out good products. But to change a policy that has been a longstanding policy with no guidelines, no information on how this should be implemented, it definitely, I think, has not just a chilling effect, but in my case, a halting effect on the kind of scrutiny that I would give the Trump administration, and it will certainly flow to others.
Last question, Joe. Mm-hmm. Over your long career in reporting and journalism, there were obviously many notable characters that you reported on. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, who was the most memorable?
With Nelson Mandela.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, because he was a statesman like any other that I've, unlike any other that I've covered. I mean, I think he was more principled and more honest about himself and the situation than I think any other president that I've covered. Now, I mean, I came to Washington in 1984, so I was covering Reagan and in one way or another covered presidents, although, or at least their administrations, ever since then. And many other politicians, some of whom I admire, some I don't, but I've never seen anyone who seemed to be as principled and as honest and also kind of open and friendly as Nelson Mandela. One of the proudest moments of my career, honestly, was introducing my mother to Nelson Mandela before he was president, you know, and I just, he was just, honestly, just an enormously important and impressive figure up close and from a distance. A lot of politicians, it might look okay from a distance, but when you get close to them, you know, you feel like it's just another, you feel like they're not being honest or open, or they're just looking for a way to enhance their reputation. I didn't get that with Nelson Mandela.
They clearly do not make global leaders like they used to.
Right.
I want to thank Joe Davidson, formerly of the Washington Post, for joining us today on Napschat. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And I want to thank Napschat listeners for logging on. If you enjoy Napschat, please leave a positive review in the podcasting platform of your choice. And more importantly, share Napschat with your friends and colleagues. In the meantime, stay safe and stay healthy.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make me